Lorena here from Everything's Canceled podcast. Herman and I hope you've been enjoying our show. The best way to support us right now is to subscribe to our Patreon for some exclusive episodes and more at patreon.com/everythingscanceled. And don't forget, there's only one L in canceled. And shop our new merch on our Shopify. The Shopify is everythingscanceled.myshopify.com. Now let's get to today's show. You're listening to Everything's Canceled podcast with your hosts,
Herman
and Lorena. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you're listening to right now and follow us on Instagram at Everything's Canceled podcast. In each episode, we discuss topics in detail that could be triggering for some listeners, so please listen with care.
All content provided in this podcast is for general information and entertainment purposes only. Any copyrighted content reproduced in this podcast is done so in accordance with Section 107 of the Copyright Act, allowing fair use and is not an infringement of copyright. Any information discussed referring to specific incidents are allegations only, unless proven otherwise in a court of law. Due to the changing nature of laws, rules, and regulations, the host will make no representations to the accuracy or completeness of any information in this podcast and will not be liable for any errors, omissions, nor the availability of this information, for any losses, injuries, or damage from the display or use of this information.
Welcome back to Everything's Canceled. We are here today to do the episode that I've been really looking forward to. I think you guys needed a break from... We've just been really heavy lately on the show.
Everything's been real dark, and this one's going to be fun.
Yeah, this one's definitely more fun. We're going to talk about Pee Wee Herman today, which is where Herman here got his name, because when we started the show, we both picked people who had been canceled in society that we felt like shouldn't be canceled. And so this one's been on the back burner, and it turns out we actually didn't know everything.
Yeah, who's canceled this week, Lorena?
Yeah, Pee Wee Herman. We're going to talk about our relationship to Pee Wee and his show all the way up to his first arrest and, spoiler alert, his second arrest, which we had no idea existed. So we're going to talk a little bit about one of the OG cancellations.
We'd heard about it, but we just didn't really know many of the details.
I had never heard he was arrested again.
I remember hearing about it, but just not really, like, it was something that was kind of glossed over. It was like it had already happened before, and it was a lot easier to forget, I think.
Right. Do you want to start with your relationship to Pee Wee Herman, which Pee Wee Herman's real name is Paul Rubens. Pee Wee's the character, so... What is your relationship with Pee-wee?
I mean, Pee-wee came at exactly the right time for me. I was a huge Pee-wee fan. I watched a ton of Pee-wee when I was a kid. Pee-wee's Playhouse. Those characters, they're so fun, and they're really nostalgic for me. I watched a lot of it. And then I remember they were... played reruns of Pee-wee's Playhouse on like Fox Family in the late 90s. And so after Pee-wee's initial cancellation and him becoming this big joke and then kind of disappearing, then I remember it would play in the mornings before I went to school, like when I was in high school. And so then I remember like revisiting Pee-wee and like getting to see all the characters again. And I feel like Pee-wee's done that a lot, where it's like he was very famous at the time. This was a character that like really, I mean, became really large, and he appeared in a ton of stuff in addition to, you know, being in his own movies. But how about you? Go ahead.
Yeah. So my relationship to Pee-wee is not typical. By the time he was arrested, I hadn't even been born yet. It was like the year before I was born, I think. So the very first time I ever heard of Pee-wee was, I was a weird kid. I was definitely an outsider to my family. I was the weird one. I was always into art. I was always into wild and crazy things, interesting things, vintage things. And my parents would often like slip in this weird insult that I had no reference for it, but they would often call me Pee-wee. I remember getting to decorate my room growing up. I ended up being heavily inspired by Pee-wee's Playhouse. You know, the joke that I was the Pee-wee Herman of the family was something I grew up having. And then I remember staying the night in middle school with, you know, one of my friends that's still my best friend today. And Pee-wee Herman had been brought up and they were like, "You've seen it, right?" And I was like, "No, I've never seen Pee-wee. I mean, I've heard the name. My parents have called me Pee-wee, but I'd never seen it." And her family put it on. And I instantly fell in love. I think the thing about Pee-wee is that his show and his character is really timeless and ageless. And it's so funny. And the house in the show is so interesting. Like, anybody at any age would dream of living in a house like that. And I was instantly captivated. And yeah, like I said, later on after that, I got to decorate my room. I painted it bright orange.
I wanted a foil ball like Pee-wee's. I had like this, I remember seeing that the giant foil ball as a kid and being like, "That's so cool. I'm going to collect all the foil and make a giant ass foil ball like that too," which is of course ridiculous, but it's just like such a funny and fun idea.
Well, when we talk about like building our own house someday, like I want Pee-wee's door. I want that red, like
the
zigzag
door. Yeah.
It's my favorite.
Who was your favorite character in the Playhouse?
I mean, Pee-wee. That was the thing, is like, I loved him. And all the other characters were like,
okay,
like Mr. Rogers, same with Mr. Rogers. Like, I love Mr.
Yeah,
Rogers, but
I watched a lot
and
of
he
Mr.
had a lot
Rogers
of characters.
Too, Sesame Street, like that. I was like that era for sure. But
okay,
Pee-wee really stands out as being so fun. Cowboy Curtis.
Cowboy
oh, yeah.
Curtis,
Lawrence
probably.
Fishburne.
Hey, Cowboy Curtis, did you just come from church?
No.
Then why are your boots so holy?
Yeah, they do look a mite poorly, don't they, Pee-wee? You know, I sure do wish I had a new pair of boots.
Wish? Did somebody say wish?
Cowboy Curtis did, Jombie. He needs a new pair of boots. Would it be all right if I gave him my wish?
Sure it would, Pee-wee. But you know, you only get one wish a day. Are you sure you want to?
Yes, I'm sure. Doing something for someone else will make me feel good.
All right, then. One pair of cowboy boots coming up. What size?
Size 12, double E.
Boy, big feet.
Well, you know what they say.
No, what?
But big feet, big boots.
Wild West spirits, join in cahoots and give Cowboy Curtis a new pair of boots.
Ooh-wee! Oh, these are beauties!
Dude, Pee-wee lore runs so deep. I had so much fun researching this episode and getting into all this stuff. Like, there's just so many fun Pee-wee stories, and everybody he worked with, he knew everybody. Everybody's so much fun. My favorite character was Terry.
Yeah, he's
and
your least
I also
favorite.
Gotta love Jombie too. Such a great character.
Do you have a least favorite character?
Yeah, I was scared of the door-to-door salesman when I was a kid because it would play like the like scary music when you would come to the door,
oh,
and everybody would run away.
I'm going door-to-door to make you this incredible offer.
So I remember that being like scary. And for some reason, I didn't like Knucklehead either, too. The, like, big hand that would knock and he would tell knock-knock jokes. So I think I would just get confused about... I was pretty young when this was on. I mean, we were talking about, like, I was, like, 3 or 4 years old. So, you know, these are, like, early... I think I just got confused between, like, when Knucklehead and the door-to-door salesman would come to the door. It was just all scary. Oh, also the Countess. Love Countess. What a great character. They're all so good, dude.
I
it's
really
so
don't
fun.
Like Cherry, and the more that we have
what?
To watch it,
what?
I know. So, a little more into my relationship with Pee-wee, when I moved to Arizona, I would have to drive back to California all the time with him for custody, and on the way, there's like a pit stop. I believe it's in California, though, on the California side.
I don't remember where it is, but the dinosaurs, right?
Yeah, and it's the dinosaurs from Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and they're massive. And so one day I, like, intentionally made sure to find it and stop and took my kids out, and we took pictures there.
I remember the desert out there, but I cannot remember exactly where it is.
Yeah, and I wanted them to understand, like, where it came from, so I took the opportunity to give Pee-wee to them. And then, you know, years later, we... recently had a baby. He's almost 2. And he loves Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yeah, he
oh
loved it right
God.
Away. Right away.
He loves it. He will watch entire episodes. Just he laughs. It's so cute.
Yeah.
And now that we have to watch it all the time, I really hate Cherry. And it's because the chair with the face. There's something about it that's very, like, crooked to me, and it does this optical illusion to me where it's like crooked, it's like leaning forward but not. I hate it. There's something about
Cherry's
it.
Cherry's like sweet and a good friend.
I don't like Cherry. I don't like Cherry, but that's all right.
I think that Pee-wee's Playhouse, in addition to like a couple other shows, when I like went back and started watching it again as an adult, and I haven't revisited some of these other shows, but I was shocked at how much is like, wow, this influenced my sense of humor and what I think is funny so much. Between that, Ren and Stimpy, and The Simpsons. The Simpsons is probably my all-time favorite TV show, and I'll always come back to The Simpsons, and I've always continued to watch The Simpsons since you watch that like on reruns. But like, Pee-wee has popped up back and a couple times, and I had like a lot of thoughts revisiting it. But one of them that was that really distinct thought is like, oh, wow, this is a lot of what I think is funny is the type of humor in this. And I think that influenced me a lot, like watching it as a kid.
You say that it influenced your humor. And for me, I think as a kid, like I said, I felt so different than my family. I was always the weird one in the house that I craved anything on screen. We've talked about how we were both big TV kids. Anything on screen that made me feel not different or some sort of like world where I would have been accepted. And Pee-wee's Playhouse was big for that. I was like, oh, there's people out there like me who would decorate their house like that. And I'm going to share some Pee-wee quotes throughout this episode. He really talks about how that was his intention of normalizing weirdness, normalizing the abnormal. And that's my favorite part of Pee-wee, and that he was able to give me intentional
about the way that he portrayed the character and the type of character building he did.
Yeah, he just inspired me to be myself. And I think that, you know, that was his intention and it worked. No one has to be like Pee-wee to feel like they're accepted by Pee-wee and Pee-wee's world.
Yeah, I think everything is wild and crazy, and that is normal and fun. And Pee-wee, he goes through the world like everything is a source of joy for Pee-wee, you know?
He's so wholesome and so innocent. There's no ulterior motives with Pee-wee's character. He's so genuine.
Yeah, Pee-wee, you know, in the movies in particular, he encounters all of these different people in the world, and he has all these different, like, funny and silly encounters, but it's all about bouncing Pee-wee and this silly boyish character off of all of these sometimes real world type characters, sometimes all different types of archetypes from movies. He loves to dig into nostalgia and characters from old movies and tropes and bring those back. He's so clever with those things. It's such a big part of the character and the movies.
So do we dive into Pee-wee's history? So
yeah, let's move on a little bit.
Pee-wee's real name, like we said, is Paul Reubens. He was born August 27th, 1952, making him a Virgo. Okay. And he died July 2023.
Yeah, he died recently. And I remember that happening as well because he died of cancer, of lung cancer. And he did not publicly state that he had cancer, that he was battling with cancer. And he was like fairly active on social media. His social media account is still active. I mean, I don't know exactly how much Paul Reubens was doing it, but it was definitely like in the character and style of Paul Reubens and Pee-wee. He just kind of suddenly died. And it was definitely a shock for his followers and fans to learn that he had been struggling with cancer.
I can't bring myself to call him Paul Reubens. I probably will not call him Paul Reubens throughout this podcast. So Pee-wee, which I think in his honor, I think he would want to be called Pee-wee through his death, everywhere.
They're synonymous in so many ways. I mean, and we'll talk about that more in the way that he developed the character and stayed in character. This is about Pee-wee here.
So the first thing that I wanted to know about Pee-wee beyond his arrest and cancellation was I wanted to know, what did Pee-wee's family think of him? So I wanted to dive a little bit into his family. They were a Jewish family. I think this is hilarious. His mom and dad owned a lamp store. Mm-hmm. His mom was also a teacher. And I feel like that comes into play with who Pee-wee is and how he talks to children.
It's interesting because Pee-wee's mom and that paints like a very quiet and domestic kind of picture of them, but Pee-wee's dad has a much more interesting history as well.
Yeah, why don't you tell us about that?
This was a detail that I was interested to learn and is a detail that was new to me. Researching Pee-wee to do this podcast, we learned that Pee-wee's father was a former pilot, a fighter pilot who was a former Royal Air Force and was also in the U.S. Army Air Force. But after that, he went on to become a founding pilot of the Israeli Defense Force, Israel Air Force. He was one of five pilots that founded the Israel Air Force, and that was founded at the time of the 1948 Arab-Israel War. It was interesting to learn. Yeah, it was just interesting to learn that now that Pee-wee's father, at least, has deep Zionist roots. And we learned this after returning from a vigil for Gaza and Palestine last night, and then we were doing research. An interesting detail to put into context of what's going on right now. And had this deep connection to the creation of Israel and the 1948 conflict and the first Nakba.
We won't go on and on about the conflict right now.
We'll continue to stay on topic here, but nonetheless, it is a relevant and interesting detail.
I don't know if we can take everything he says about his family and his stand-up comedy as true, but if any of his material is true, it implies that his parents really embraced his weirdness growing up and never embarrassed him for things like wanting to have tea parties and dress up. They didn't make him feel like he needed to be normal.
And he got into acting right away, as a child.
Yeah, he said that as a child he frequented circuses. His favorite show was I Love Lucy, which made him want to make people laugh. And he references a pivotal point in his childhood at the age of 5 when he asked his dad to build him a stage so that him and his siblings could perform, which I just think these things are really endearing. I love that he's always been this type of kid. This is one of my favorite quotes from Paul Rubens about himself. He did an interview with NPR, and I have a few quotes from that.
Oh, yeah.
He said, "I felt like a total oddball almost every minute growing up. That sort of was the whole point of the show, or at least a big point of the show, was that it would be very hard to stand out in the playhouse. Everything stood out in the playhouse, so you could feel right at home, no matter who you are or what you were thinking or anything." And I loved that.
Yeah, that's great.
Everything about Pee-wee and the character, he says, were just a bunch of jumbled up pieces of himself. And I think that's very important to remember as we go through this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's get a little bit into, first off, his education. He started out at one university for one semester, and then he moved on to the Boston University. And then he moved on to what art school was it?
He went to Cal Arts.
Cal Arts, yeah.
He didn't get accepted to a few different programs, right? But then he got accepted to Cal Arts. So
yeah,
he ended up moving to California.
I remember specifically mentioning that he got rejected from Juilliard.
Yeah.
He definitely seems like the kid who was really good at art but failed art class for some reason.
Well, it makes sense that he went to Cal Arts. So it means that he moved to Southern California. Then there he joined the sketch comedy troupe, the Groundlings.
Yeah.
And at the Groundlings, he met a number of other very influential people in comedy who would go on to influence him and go on to, he'd work with them. And this is where he began to develop the character of Pee-wee Herman, where he first came up with the character.
He says that Pee-wee Herman originated during a 1978 improv exercise with the Groundlings, where he came up with the idea of a man who wanted to be a comic but was so inept at telling jokes that it was obvious to the audience that he would never make it.
Which is definitely a classic Pee-wee bit. Tell a joke but let it trail off or not really have a punchline, or that was like a really common Pee-wee bit. And he always played it really well. It was always really funny.
Yeah, and there's just so many pieces that go into Pee-wee. He's been compared to other characters like Pinocchio or Tiny Tim. I really feel like he may have been influenced by some of Tiny Tim's weirdness.
Andy Kaufman.
Yeah.
So this always in character thing, like with Tiny Tim or Andy Kaufman.
Yeah. But he always said that there was no specific source for Pee-wee other than a collection of ideas and pieces of himself. The voice originated in 1970 when he appeared in a production of Life with Father, where he was cast as one of the most obnoxious characters in the play. He adopted this cartoon voice, and that is what became Pee-wee's voice. The name itself came from the harmonica brand Pee-wee.
Yeah, the tiny harmonicas.
The one-inch harmonicas. He had one as a child. And then the surname Herman was the last name of some energetic boy that he knew from his childhood. Some weird kid.
Some kid he knew.
Yeah, and that name stuck, and that's probably like just the name he thinks of when he thinks of a weird kid, I think.
Yeah, I remember him saying something about like Pee-wee Herman sounded like a real enough name that it sounded like something somebody wouldn't make up.
Totally. And then he's well known for his clothing, right? He wears this notable suit. It had been handmade for the director of Groundlings, Gary Austin, and he passed it on to Rubens and he kept it. So it's a little small, it's a little tight. And it's funny because it did go on to sort of influence fashion.
It's a bit of a stretch maybe, but yeah, I guess like that
they go on about
like,
the way they cut the shoulders and the tight like, fitting. And
yeah, like a vintage style suit with like thin lapels or something.
And then the red tie that he wears, basically he claims that someone just handed it to him. It's a little kid's bow tie before one of his performances and he kept it.
Right. It's funny because that's considered like such an iconic part of his image, but it was just something that was just like part of the character. It was just kind of thrown together.
He said that he never really thought of his character as one for children before the 80s. Once it became a character for children and for the show, he was really selective about what should and should not be associated with the Pee-wee character. Mm-hmm. For instance, apparently he was a really heavy cigarette smoker, and he hired security just to make sure that kids never saw him with a cigarette while in costume. Pee-wee did go on to create an entire Pee-wee franchise that had toys and clothes. Apparently, it earned $25 million at its peak in 1988, and he did eventually get his Hollywood Walk of Fame star in 1989. So it's a little bit about his character, but the most interesting thing about his character was that he stayed in character all the time. He wanted to be known as that person, and he only does interviews as him.
The idea was that he wanted the public to think that Pee-wee Herman was a real person, so he didn't credit himself as Paul Rubens. He was credited as Pee-wee as himself. And anytime he appeared in public, anytime he appeared in anything, he was just always appeared as Pee-wee. I think that's one thing that confused the public about Pee-wee as well, right? Because there's a lot of confusing things about the character of Pee-wee. It's obviously an adult man pretending to be a boy, for one. So that's like a little confusing and sometimes a little weird. And then also there's this character, Pee-wee Herman. Is this a real person or not? Does he have another name? You would have to ask yourself that question at some point, right? And I guess if you didn't find him funny or amusing, that might be weird, very weird.
That's what I was going to say was like when you watch interviews with him on talk shows, he comes on the show, they have no idea what to expect. Pee-wee shows up every time and they're confused and they're just sort of like, are you for real? And he's just this annoying kid. He plays with balloons and makes them squeal in his face. He brings toys out of his suit and they're always kind of waiting for him to get serious. And at some point you see them sort of accept, this is what I brought on the show and I'm here for it. I'm getting trolled.
Oh, I'm pretty sure it was all planned, but he did make numerous appearances on late night shows. And yeah, those are the types of things he did.
Even if it was planned, you can tell the talk show hosts, like as people, are still like a little confused on what to think. Is this guy weird? Is this all a joke? Is this all a facade? Or is he actually like this as a person? Like you can tell they're trying to figure it out. Like they're meeting Pee-wee and they're processing.
It works really good because it makes a good foil as like a straight man where it's just like, what, why are you doing this type of thing? And then Pee-wee's just yakking it up and pulling toys out of his pockets and cracking jokes and badly. And
he's
being
so
Pee-wee.
Joyful. He's so happy. I love the ones where he talks about like his trips to Hawaii and he brought back like souvenirs for people. It's just so sweet and cute and exactly how you would expect a conversation with a kid to go.
Well, all of these late night appearances took place in between when he developed the character of Pee-wee at the Groundlings. And then he had an interview to be on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
And he did not get the part on Saturday Night Live.
And he was upset. He was mad about it.
Yeah. And so he went back to Hollywood And he said, I'm going to make my own show. I'm going to create a stage show and I'm going to do it myself. And so that's exactly what he did. He created the Pee Wee Herman Show, which was a live stage show that debuted at the Roxy Theater in Hollywood in 1981.
And then from there, he did some movies, right?
Well, yeah. And then that's when he started like really promoting the character of Pee Wee and did the late night appearances that we were talking about. And that led to his movie deal where he developed the film Pee Wee's Big Adventure. And that movie came out in 1985. And it's, what a great movie that is. There are so many funny parts. There are so many funny characters.
I'm just into like the weird mixture of art media in it. Like there's clay, there's bright colors. Everything's a little all over the place. Some is real, some is fake. That's my favorite part about Pee-wee stuff.
The infamous Rube Goldberg breakfast machine scene, the dinosaurs, your big butt. I'm a loner, Dottie, a rebel.
There's a lot of things about me you don't know anything about, Dottie. Things you wouldn't understand. Things you couldn't understand. Things you shouldn't understand.
I don't understand.
Pee-wee visits the Alamo is one of my personal favorite parts. Large Marge.
Be sure and tell him Large Marge sent ya.
It's just such a great fucking movie. It's so much fun. And, of course, one of the early films from director Tim Burton.
Right.
And so this is really like a film that was like one of his first major films that really put Tim Burton out there and led to him making his next big films, which are the ones that we kind of know him the best for.
Which is?
Yeah, he'd go on to do Edward Scissorhands and Beetlejuice like right after this.
Right.
And then that leads to Pee-wee getting a deal with CBS to produce a TV show, Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yeah. And do we know how many episodes there were?
There were 5 seasons, 45 episodes. I think it ran from 86 to 91.
I think it actually ran to 1990.
Maybe 90.
The next year, 91, was his arrest, and it had already closed up shop.
Yeah, they had just finished with Pee-wee's Playhouse. And yeah, I remember him saying that he was ready to move on.
He grew his hair out.
Yeah.
As we see in his mugshot. His mugshot does not look like Pee-wee, that's for sure.
And a couple of the people who helped him create Pee-wee's Playhouse are also people who worked with him at the Groundlings, who also went on to be very well-known comedians. Actor Phil Hartman.
Oh, a sailor travels to many lands, any place he pleases. And he always remembers to wash his hands so he don't get no diseases.
Who is one of the funniest people of all time, R.I.P. Phil Hartman. Also so well known from all of his great work on The Simpsons, my other favorite show. And then he was great on Pee-wee. He's in so many other great things. He's great in everything. News radio. So funny. Some other people who helped develop the Pee-wee's Playhouse show from the Groundlings were John Paragon. We'd know him from playing several characters on the Playhouse. He was the voice of Terry and also played Jombie. And another person who helped develop the show was Lynn Marie Stewart. She was on the Playhouse as well. We'd know her for playing the most beautiful girl in Puppetland, Missy Vaughn. And she's also in a ton of other stuff, too. They both are. They contribute to a lot of other things. She played a nurse on MASH. She played a bunch of characters in Laverne and Shirley. You might know her as Charlie's mom on Always Sunny.
She's the hot one, right? It was like Charlie's.
She had like the big bouffant, like a beehive hairdo and the big dresses on the Playhouse. Now she's kind of like a small woman with like, she has short red hair and like like kind of sweet face. And like I said, the Pee-wee lore just runs so deep. There are so many other great characters on the Playhouse. We mentioned Cowboy Curtis earlier, played by Lawrence Fishburne. One thing that I remember really where I was talking about watching Pee-wee and watching the Playhouse again as an adult was watching and seeing like how many nostalgia references there are. Like everything in the Playhouse is some funky old thing. Everything's retro. Everything is funny and colorful. But then also like there are a lot of references to vintage or retro like homoerotica as well. There's the character of Rico. He plays like a lifeguard at the Playhouse pool.
He's a shirtless lifeguard.
Yeah, he's shirtless. And he's
who makes
like
a lot of fruitcake jokes sometimes.
Yeah, like a hunky dude. And this is something that, of course, missed me as a very young child when I was watching the Playhouse. But going back, it's like, oh, well, clearly something that Pee-wee does a lot is dig into the, like, retro camp and kitsch, that type of aesthetic. And a lot of it is this gay camp, the type of things that drag queens and, you know, those characters represent. And so you get a lot of that through the Playhouse, which is, it's fun and it's entertaining and it's colorful and it's great.
Yeah. Speaking of the queer-coded characters on the show, Pee-wee's sexuality has been, you know, a huge topic around him and the character, and it's always been sort of a mystery. Pee-wee's sexuality has never mattered, though, because his character was so innocent and his show had such great, vibrant material that nobody ever really cared. But yeah, the Playhouse had drag queens, gay cowboys, male ladies instead of male men, shirtless lifeguards. There was a lot of queer-coded jokes, like you said. One of the most notable moments on the show that may hint at his sexuality was in an episode of Pee-wee's Playhouse. He goes on a date with Cowboy Curtis, which, like, it's supposed to be like a platonic date, but the way they act it out is very like gay coded and seemed like it was Pee-wee's like coming out moment. And he does go on to do Pee-wee's Big Holiday. And in that, his character also sort of like came out in a way where he falls in love with another character named Joe.
In the movie, it's like Pee-wee works at the diner in town, right? And then he meets a tall, dark, and handsome stranger who comes in the door and is essentially just like Pee-wee. Like, they hit it off so great.
Yeah.
And then, like, that leads to Pee-wee, like, jumping on the back of his motorcycle and them, like, taking off together. And then the whole movie's about him going to his birthday party.
Yeah, so Pee-wee's character, even though it's queer-coded, he was always sort of deemed socially as, like, asexual character. And again, him always claiming that the Pee-wee character is made of pieces of him, dissecting his sexuality is very interesting because in a time and in a world where it was difficult to come out, I sometimes wonder if he had Pee-wee as sort of an outlet for some of that.
Yeah, I think that this was another thing that, looking back on Pee-wee, I remember we raised this question to each other when we started researching this podcast. Well, what was Pee-wee's sexuality? Is he gay? He's married or not? He didn't have any kids. What's the deal? And I remember being like, I don't know. And then once I looked into it and looked back on it a little bit, it's like, well, how did I miss this, that he's just obviously gay? Or if he's not gay, maybe he's, you know, bi or pan or whatever. He's clearly under the LGBTQIA other umbrella. However, he was working with a character and in a time that obviously he never came out and he never was open about his own sexuality, about any of his own romantic relationships other than the ones that were publicized. It's also seems kind of obvious that likely as a closeted man, that's part of the idea behind playing a character like Pee-wee, where he plays this character full time. And then is that not also kind of like what a closeted person has to do in society? And I think it's also referential to other people who are gay in Hollywood who weren't able to come out. I think of like Rock Hudson.
When Pee-wee was asked, what is Pee-wee Herman's sexuality? He made it clear that Pee-wee, who is supposed to be a child and four children, didn't have a sexuality. He was asexual because children don't have a sexuality. He was sort of, he wanted to be asexual in that way as the character. And Paul Reubens' sexuality would have been separate. And Pee-wee could have been, you know, a bit of a mask for that.
Yeah, definitely. There were just so many other things learning about his life. It's like, okay, well, clearly he's more than likely a gay man. He collected homosexual erotica, for one, primarily homosexual erotica. He was a great collector of a lot of things, people and friends, kitsch and memorabilia. But one of the things he collected a lot of was pornographic erotica, particularly vintage erotica, and a lot of it was homosexual erotica.
That will become relevant, but there are mysteries around his dating life too, which do kind of make me wonder. There are rumors that Paul Rubens had asked men out on dates. There are other things that could imply that he was also into women, but his dating life is very vague and strange. Before we talk about his, quote, wedding, and I put that in quotations.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, he's known for three, quote, relationships. There were rumors that he was dating a woman named Valerie Galino because they were seen together and, you know, they went to events together. Neither of them claimed to be in a relationship, that they never claimed to be a couple.
They were co-stars and friends.
Yeah. And then after his first arrest, he was super depressed and he was in his house all the time. He credits Debbie Mazar for sort of curing his depression and getting him out of the house. But when questioned about it, Debbie said they never had sex. That it was a completely platonic relationship.
Yeah, we're friends.
And then there's this whole incident that you're going to be able to walk us through because you know more about it, where he had a mock wedding with Shandy Hefner.
This is just such a fascinating chapter in Pee-wee lore. And this was such a fun rabbit hole for me to go down. I didn't know anything about this. And I also knew so little about the people who were involved in this that once I like learned who they were connected to and other things, that I was shocked that I didn't. And it was really fun.
So fill me in, because when I looked online, there was very little.
So in 1989, Pee Wee Herman got married. And also, I want to preface this story as well, because I think that this also fits with what we're talking about, Pee Wee creating a character for himself and creating lore around that character. And like, that was something that was really entertaining for him to do. And this is a really good example of that, because why would Pee Wee do this? And it's because it's amazing. It's because it's such a great fucking story. And I'm so glad that we get to tell this story now. I'm so thankful to Pee Wee for doing these amazing things and being so incredibly interesting that he gives us this story to tell you, because it's so good. All of his, everything about him is so good. And this is just a great example. And it is also like a gay cover, like Beard Marriage Story as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So anyways, in 1989, Pee Wee Herman got married to Shandy Hefner in Hawaii.
Also, to preference this is before he was canceled. So he was still like a very loved. This is at the height of his fame.
Yeah, absolutely. This is like, after the movie, this is like, yeah, everybody knows who Pee Wee is. Pee Wee's huge at this point. And so if Pee Wee Herman got married, it would be in the news, right?
Yeah.
And so he marries a woman named Shandy Hefner. Who is that?
Honestly, the last name threw me off. I was like, Hefner?
Right.
Like, I didn't know.
Shandy Hefner was like a hippie lady. When you read articles and they describe her as like an ex Hare Krishna belly dancer, like free spirit hippie type.
Okay.
She was adopted as an adult.
Which threw me off too. I was like, what?
Mm-hmm. When she was 35 in 1988, she was adopted as an adult by Doris Duke when she was 75.
Why? Do we know what that's about?
There are endless conspiracies about what their relationship, the nature of their relationship, whether they were lovers or not, why they were in this relationship, what they had to do with like the adoption, whether Shandy Hefner was a plant to try and get to Doris Duke, because Doris Duke was known as the richest girl in the world. Doris Duke is a tobacco heiress because she is the daughter of James Buchanan Duke. James Buchanan Duke owned the American Tobacco Company, Duke Energy, and he's also the namesake of Duke University. He owned the company that made cigarettes, the company that made rolled cigarettes. I'm pretty sure that eventually like that was broken up in like an antitrust thing back when that type of thing actually happened. But nonetheless, this leads to his daughter Doris Duke. She led the most fantastically interesting life. There are so many stories about her, and she went so many places and did so many things that I will not even begin to touch on them here. But she was very rich, obviously, because she was a heiress to this massive fortune, and she traveled the world. She was married several times, but she was known to also... She was known to be with other men, a number of other men, many different famous men. She started traveling to Hawaii with her husband, and they loved Hawaii, and they wanted to build a house in Hawaii. And they built a house. It's near Honolulu, like on Oahu, and they built this house, and it's called Shangri-La. And the house is... I'll post some pictures on our Instagram of this house so everybody can see it, but do yourself a favor and look up what this place looks like. Like I said, these people were fantastically rich, and they traveled the world, and on their honeymoon, Doris Duke and her husband traveled all over like the Arab world, the Middle East, and Northern Africa, and they collected thousands of artifacts and textiles, and everything in this house is Middle Eastern themed, and it's incredible. It's hard to describe. It's an amazing structure. It's incredibly beautiful. You know how a lot of the times rich people have shitty taste? You can't buy taste.
Okay.
This is an example of what can you do if, like, money is not an option. There are something like 4,000 artifacts of different types of art and things that were imported. There's these giant tile, like, mosaics. You just have to see it. I can't appropriately describe it.
I'm looking at the photos, and it doesn't look like I'm looking at a Hawaiian house. It looks like I'm looking at a house in the Middle East.
It's a pretty incredible place. Another really interesting thing about her that I learned that was new to me was that she became close friends with the Waikiki Beach Boys, and she was friends with the Kahanamoku brothers, and she was known to be close with Duke Kahanamoku, who is the father of modern surfing. Without Duke Kahanamoku, there would be no surfing as we know it. His trip to California and when he surfed and introduced basically like the mainland to surfing as we know it, he's responsible for creating surf culture. And he's also a really interesting figure who, he was an Olympic champion swimmer, but as a native Hawaiian, he's very dark skinned. And this is at a time when dark skinned people were not allowed to swim in the same pools as white people. So there was a lot of controversy around this, but he was an incredible athlete. He broke world records as a swimmer, and he also is the father of modern surfing. And him and Doris Duke were known to associate. I read that she was the first non-Hawaiian woman to compete in surfing by surfing with Duke Kahanamoku. It goes on and on and on with Doris Duke and the stories. They're very entertaining. But anyways...
So she adopts...
Shandi Hefner in 1988, who marries Pee Wee Herman in a ceremony at Doris Duke's Shangri-La house in Hawaii. And this ceremony is presided over, and the marriage certificate is signed by Imelda Marcos, because this is during the time at which Imelda Marcos formerly deposed former first lady dictator of the Philippines was currently at the time exiled in Hawaii. And so she also is wrapped up in this story because she presided over Pee Wee Herman's marriage to Shandi Hefner. This marriage, they weren't really married. They never were together. I don't know if like they ended up getting divorced or not, like whether the marriage was ever even really legal.
No, it wasn't legal. He kept the temporary license like as a souvenir forever.
Yeah, exactly. It's a show. You know what I mean? It was something that was done to create this funny story. But one thing that's interesting about Shandi Hefner and Doris Duke is that since Doris Duke died, Shandi Hefner has tried to make a claim to Doris Duke's money, and Doris Duke did not leave her money to Shandi Hefner. She ended up leaving all of her money in the form of a couple different charitable organizations, and then she made her former butler. She put him in control of all of these organizations and essentially in control of what was left of her vast fortune.
Is this the story of Mr. Deeds right now?
She did not leave that money to Shandi Hefner. She did buy Shandi Hefner like a fairly large horse ranch in Hawaii, which is where she still lives to this day. She became a Republican donor in the 2000s.
Interesting.
And that's the last news I really heard that was relevant about Shandi, other than her still trying to get at Doris Duke's money, I guess.
All right. Well, that's the Pee Wee and Shandi Hefner fake marriage story, I guess, which is Pee-wee's closest thing to marriage that he ever did. And like we said, he never had children. Pee-wee's love life continues to be a mystery through his death. His sexuality, too.
Yeah. We can certainly speculate, but it was something that he was not open about.
Yeah. So that is the Pee-wee story of how much we love him and our backgrounds with him and who he is as a person, which was laying the foundation for his cancellation. So Pee-wee got arrested twice. But the first time...
Yeah, we got to talk about that first one because that's the big one that everybody knows.
Yeah, and it's so strange because this is the one that got him canceled. As far as we're concerned, and we'll let you...
turned him into a big joke.
Yeah, and we'll let you decide how you feel about it. But for us, it always seemed like such a small offense that really wrecked him. In fact, he said in an interview, "I probably have become more infamous from two misdemeanors than probably anyone I could think of." He just implies that maybe... because of the nature of the charges and that he was a children's icon, that is probably what did him in here. But let's just walk through this first arrest. So it's 1991.
Mm-hmm. Set the scene for us, Lorena.
We're in Florida.
Pee-wee is in Sarasota, Florida.
And he goes to a porno theater, which, I don't know, I think this could be a generational thing between me and Herman here. But, like, I didn't really understand what a porno theater was, because like my only reference for that is I know that there's like back rooms of sex toy stores because everyone watches porn at home now. Like, you don't go to theaters to watch porn anymore. So apparently there were theaters that played rated X movies.
Yeah, movies. This was actually a big thing at the time because
labeled as such on the outside?
Think of like a time before home video too, when the only way to really get your pornographic material was either like in print, or if it was a film, then it would have been fairly difficult to play unless it's like Super 8 or 68, something that you would play at home. So like pornographic theaters were absolutely a thing. And then there was also a series of very popular pornographic movies in the 70s too, when X ratings became a thing, and like there was Deep Throat. Deep Throat was the big one.
Yeah, Deep Throat's super famous.
And it was like this movie came out, it was treated like a theatrical film, and like lots of people went to go see it. But then there was also, of course, like there were porno theaters that played these CD movies. I think it was really fairly commonplace at a certain time. You know, I'm sure different communities had different laws about whether they were allowed to have those theaters and potentially about what they're allowed to play, whether they're allowed to exhibit like homosexual type of things. And then we're also going to talk a little bit about how those laws have changed over time too, because that affects Pee-wee with his other arrest too. But let's stick to the 91 arrest here, Sarasota, Florida,
so
at the adult movie theater.
I had to Google this because I just can't envision exactly what these theaters are. They look like the outside of a strip club, but it's a movie theater. It's labeled XXX Theater.
You've never even seen one like in real life? You've never seen it? I remember the...
No, I mean, like I said, I wasn't sure if these were like curtained behind the back of sex toy stores or something like that.
As recently as 15 years ago or so, I was living in Hollywood, and the part of Hollywood I was living in near Santa Monica and Western, there was an old school adult movie theater there. And I think it was really one of the last ones around, but it was still there at that time.
Yeah, so from the pictures, it looks like any other theater, but a lot smaller. So that is the setting. And it's a sting. There's an unexpected, you know, police sting.
While it's legal to have these movie theaters, and it's obviously, it would have been legal to go into the movie theaters, it's illegal to masturbate in these theaters or to indecently expose yourself in the movie theaters. Paul Rubens was there this day, and we did some research because we were curious for a number of reasons to find out what film he may or may not have been seeing at the theater that day. And I've confirmed that the film is called Nancy Nurse from 1991. It's easily available if you need to see the movie that Paul Rubens was watching that day. You can definitely find it online.
They detained him as he was leaving. They also arrested three other men that were there. The kicker of the story that I had never heard before was that when they looked at his driver's license, he whispered to them, "I'm Pee-wee Herman." And then he offered to perform a children's benefit for the sheriff's office to take care of this. So
he's like, I can do a kid's show or something if we can.
Yeah, so then they're able to charge him with bribery on top of that. So
I think his lawyer tried to do the same thing as well. I think his lawyer also was like, hey, can't we make this go away?
Yeah, yeah. It says here his attorney.
Did this just as a show for you or something?
Yeah, his attorney extended the same offer, it says.
So yeah, slow day for the cops in Sarasota, Florida. So they send him down to the adult theater to get the whack off guys, and
well, the attorney
Pee-wee was there that day.
The attorney offered them the same thing, to withhold the story. I guess back in 1971, he had been arrested in the same county for loitering near an adult theater, but the charges had been dropped.
Yeah.
So exactly 20 years later, he gets arrested. So he had been frequenting these adult theaters.
He had,
you know,
one other arrest too. Did you catch what that one was for?
Oh, the possession of marijuana in 83.
Yeah, he got caught with weed back in 83.
I can't tell.
So Pee-wee had a record.
But apparently he traveled back to Nashville, where his sister and lawyer lived, and then to New Jersey, where he stayed the following months at his friend Doris Duke's estate. It was after the marijuana charge that he went to Doris Duke's estate. I guess he's been friends with her for a while.
Yeah, they were friends.
So anyways, it blew up.
Yeah, the media gets a hold of this, and this becomes a big deal. Not only was it a big story, but it became a really big subject of humor, with like Pee-wee being the butt of jokes, especially on late night talk shows.
They pulled his toys from the store. They did everything.
Yeah, Pee-wee gets canceled here for sure.
They remove the reruns from TV.
Mm-hmm. CBS ends up pulling the reruns of Pee-wee's Playhouse.
He pleaded no contest. The plea avoided a charge on his record, but it obligated him to 75 hours of community service. And ironically, as part of this community service, he had to create and produce and finance two anti-drug PSAs, public service announcements, and we watched them, and they were great.
Oh, yeah. Well, you'll be seeing that one on our Instagram as well.
Oh, yeah, we'll put that on Instagram, but so hilarious. You got to look them up.
It almost becomes a bit of a classic Pee-wee bit because it's so good.
I love anti-drug commercials. They make me laugh so hard. They're so good.
Despite getting canceled, Pee-wee does get a lot of support from his friends and supporters. A number of celebrities who are his friends make statements of support. Cyndi Lauper, Annette Funicello, Zsa Gabor. And then when CBS pulls the reruns of Playhouse, some supporters even go as far as having free Pee-wee rallies.
Yeah, full protests.
Yeah, and there's a great video as well online of people in Hollywood at the Roxy Theater, and they're having a free Pee-wee rally before a midnight showing of Pee-wee's Big Adventure. It's very entertaining. They have fantastic free Pee-wee t-shirts and slogans. It's just really funny.
We're going to have some free Pee-wee merch on our Shopify.
Oh, yeah. Pee-wee merch incoming.
Yeah.
Before the movie, one of the presenters reads a statement in support of Pee-wee by Teller of Penn and Teller.
Oh, nice.
And it's pretty long, but I'm either going to transcribe it or I'll stick it on the end of this so you get to hear it. So look forward to Teller's statement in defense of Pee-wee.
I love them. But basically, it was interesting because as much as he had support, this kind of was the end of Pee-wee. He didn't really do many interviews again. He never really shows up as Pee-wee again.
No, he's able to do some bit parts and
some little
appearances,
but it kind of ended him. I think people were weirded out that this person had betrayed himself as a child, and the lines are very blurred between like man-child and child and person who like took his dick out in a theater and was masturbating in public. I guess we can just kind of get into our thoughts here. For me, I'm just like, I am not sure I would ever walk into one of those theaters and expect anything but people jerking off.
Of course.
I mean, I guess they probably have like a rule against it, but I figured it would just be
it
something.
It was technically illegal.
Yeah, but I guess it would have thought that the etiquette would just be like, hey, if someone's in there like harassing you and bothering you, we'll do something about it. I imagine people sit several seats apart and it's dark and it's probably low key, but they're definitely all there to do that.
I'd imagine some cruising takes place as well.
first off, it's bizarre that the cops felt like they needed to do a sting.
Obviously, it's just a slow day for Sarasota PD and send whoever's low on the totem pole out to bust the whack off, guys.
But as far as this cancellation goes, I was really pro Pee-wee. I was just like, that's silly. Like, he's allowed to masturbate in an adult space during an adult movie. No one was harmed in the making of this cancellation. And so I always thought it was kind of funny, but it sucks. It sucks that it ruined his career. And I was just sort of like in the camp of free Pee-wee for sure.
Yeah, essentially, I agree with what Pee-wee said, which is that it didn't really seem like a crime and that it's really nobody's business but his own.
And for the record, Pee-wee has remained adamant all the way to the day he died that he actually never had his penis out of his pants. So I don't know if that means his hands were in his pants. I don't know if it means that he was really not doing anything.
Or whether the cops were just arresting him, or whether I had a suspicion, especially when I thought that this might have been a gay movie or like a gay movie theater, that they were potentially like these cops were there to bust them specifically because there may have been homosexual activity going on. And so that was definitely a suspicion I had. I did confirm that the movie is not a gay porno, but nonetheless, I would still imagine that some cruising probably takes place or took place in these theaters. That pretty much stands to reason.
Yeah, here's some quotes straight from Paul Rubin himself about this incident when he was interviewed later. He said, I thought Pee Wee Herman worked better if one didn't know that I was an actor, so I went out of my way to try and get the public to think that I was a real person. But on July 26, 1991, that separation between actor and icon disappeared in a flash. It had been a year since I wrapped up the production on the final season of Pee-wee's Playhouse, and I was catching a triple feature in an adult movie theater in Sarasota, Florida. Undercover police were in the theater too, and they said they witnessed an act of indecent exposure. The interviewer says, I think the question everyone was asking at the time was, what were you thinking? And he said, well, obviously I wasn't thinking, you know. I certainly wasn't thinking to myself, you're a children's show host. Your show is still on television. I felt like they were insinuating, like, well, I was sitting in, you know, a darkened movie theater in my Pee-wee suit. But you had to know that being caught in a place like that, being a children's entertainer, would lead to everything getting blown up. He said, I guess I did have to know that, but yet there I was. I mean, that didn't seem like a crime to me. It didn't seem like anyone's business but my own. And the interviewer said, what about the indecent exposure part of it? He said, I maintain at the time that it didn't happen, and I maintain that still to this day. He ultimately pleaded no contest to the charges and paid the $75 fine because he feared that a trial would only prolong an already very embarrassing situation.
So this was just very much of the time. This is just so 1991, Pee-wee is canceled, Pee-wee is a joke.
This is also like at the height of some satanic panic of like about pedophiles, panic about our children and what they're watching. And there's the whole church crowd, you know, you've got to protect your children.
Won't somebody please think of the children?
Just like we were talking in the Drake Bell episode, a lot of homophobic ideas that gay men must touch children. And then here you have this man who's queer coded and he has a children's show and now he's masturbated in public.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that whole side of society that's really stirring up all of these fantastical ideas instead of just a man was jerking off in a private theater like dudes do.
I think Pee-wee as a concept was already a little much for some people to take. And then this was too much.
Yeah, if people were confused on whether he was weird or strange or stupid or creepy, I think that this shoved them in the direction that he was weird and creepy and like inappropriate.
Yeah, it was already a bizarre character, and then you add this context, and that was all people talked about when they talked about Pee-wee. That was really it. Before we move on, he did make an appearance at the 1991 MTV Video Music Awards. Did you catch that one?
No.
And so this is like immediately after his cancellation, after everything goes down. And he wouldn't make a whole lot of appearances. Like I said, he did do things after this. He did continue to work, but just nowhere near on the level of the fame that he had before. But he made appearance on the 1991 MTV Video Music Awards. And he gets a huge round of applause. And then he asks...
Oh, his joke. Yeah.
Yeah. He asks the audience, heard any good jokes lately?
Yeah.
And of course, Pee Wee Herman was the butt of every single joke in everything, in late night humor everywhere. So
that's pretty cute. Yeah, that's a good one, Pee Wee. Yeah, he did go on. I'll just list real quick. After this, he was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Tim Burton's Batman Returns, Matilda, Dunstan Checks In, and The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah, so he continued working with Tim Burton.
After this, he sort of keeps a low profile, and he really focuses on his writing. And then, oddly enough, this is when he really picks up his collecting hobby. He starts collecting a variety of things, everything from fake food to lamps, like his parents, to, like we talked about earlier, vintage erotica. It's interesting because we talked about how strange Brian Peck's house was in the Drake episode, of like this weird like clown painting and shit.
Paul Rubens probably had all the exact same type of shit.
Yeah, I think that this is like a weird Hollywood thing. Like when you have money and you live in a place where you can get strange things, you're going to fill your house. I would fill my house with strange shit.
Yeah, I think we want to say like, oh, Brian Peck is such a creep and it's weird and creepy that he had things that teenagers would like or vintage Hollywood memorabilia in his house.
No, I think we're all creeped out by the John Wayne Gacy clown gift.
That wasn't particularly unique. A lot of people used to write to John Wayne Gacy and he sent a lot of people paintings as well. So I think they kind of sensationalize it in the Quiet on Set documentary, but that's not that uncommon.
Anyways, weirdo.
Can we talk about kind of the return of Paul Rubens in 1999?
Yeah. Are you going to talk about Mystery Men and Blow?
Yeah. So after this period of not really appearing very much and not really being in the public's eye, although, like Lorena said, he does continue to work, Paul Rubens is cast in the 1999 film Mystery Men, and he plays a superhero character in it. He does not play Pee Wee Herman. He is Paul Rubens. He's cast as Paul Rubens. And to promote this film, for the first time, Paul Rubens promotes it as Paul Rubens and not as Pee Wee Herman. He goes on late night TV and he interviews as himself. And so this is really the first time that he ever fully drops the Pee-wee character and just comes out as himself. And it's all in service of this 1999 film, Mystery Men. It was like a big star vehicle film. I remember seeing it in the movie theater because I was in high school at this time. It was a total flop. It's a bummer because it's a really crappy movie. But it was the return of Paul Rubens.
And then he was in the movie Blow, of all, like, to go from Pee Wee Herman to Blow, which is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, and this is, on the other hand, is a great movie, and Paul Rubens' performance is great.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Johnny Depp is the star in that show, and it was hard for me to remember Paul Rubens being in it, but yeah, great movie, great production, but it was just so strange that he went from Pee Wee Herman to masturbating in a theater to being in Blow. I'm like, okay, like, we took a direction there. Full left turn.
I think, and that movie really did have an impact as far as that being a very successful movie and that bringing Paul Rubens back to a mainstream audience and as an actor, not Pee Wee Herman. I think that's really a film that was a kind of a breakout at that time in a way.
Right after Mystery Men and Blow, he says, things were going great. Things were really, really going good. And then they weren't. In November of 2001, I was on the set of an Elton John video when the phone rang. I got a call from someone saying, the police are at your house with a search warrant. What were they looking for? He said, child pornography. He says, the moment I realized my name was going to be said in the same sentence as children and sex, that's really intense. That's something that I knew from that very moment. Whatever happens past that point, something's out there in the air that is really bad. So that was November 2002.
Yeah, I was going to say that'll certainly lead us to what will be the topic of the rest of this podcast, which is this investigation and the charges against Pee Wee Herman and also against Jeffrey Jones, which was the other case that was associated with this.
Yeah, this is 2002, and the police were acting on that tip from a witness in the pornography case against the actor Jeffrey Jones.
I do want to talk about a little bit about what you said, Pee-wee, at the time that he found out about the investigation, was filming a music video.
Yeah, for Elton John.
For Elton John with David LaChapelle. And it's for a song called This Train Don't Stop Here Anymore. And we're thinking, you know, this is early 2000s. I thought that was odd. I was just like, I was a little bit curious about that. I watched the video. Did you see it, Lorena?
No.
It's like really fairly unremarkable. Paul Rubens is in it. He plays a version of young Elton John's like manager. And it follows Elton. I was looking for something like interesting or some sort of like strange smoking gun in this. And it's not like that at all. There is like a weird scene at which young Elton at the very end looks in on a room. And there's very clearly like people having like this orgiastic scene in it, and he walks away from it. But I think that it was interesting that the music video was being filmed by David LaChapelle too. Are you familiar with him at all, Lorena?
No.
He was a music video director and photographer, and he has like a very distinct style of like these like bright colors and using a lot of provocative imagery, I would say.
I mean, maybe I do. I just don't know the name, you know?
And David LaChapelle, it will definitely be a dog whistle to people who are more like deeply conspiracy minded or like Q-pilled, because David LaChapelle and the type of imagery that is in his art, his photography and music videos, is often something that is brought up when people are like conspiratorial about evil Hollywood Satanist pedophile type of stuff. And okay, that like David LaChapelle imagery like portrays that. So there's a small but tenuous connection there.
So Elton John has been canceled by QAnon?
No, I'm talking about David LaChapelle.
I know, but he directed Elton John's song, so is he
directed all?
Did Elton John sell his soul to the devil is what I'm asking.
I don't think there's much connection there. He directed this one video by Elton John. They may have worked together at other times, but David LaChapelle has photographed and made music videos for lots and lots of famous people.
To me, the more obvious connection, I'm being presumptuous here, but Elton John being very openly gay has mm-hmm. Paul Rubens on, like, the connection for me there seemed a little strong of like, why of all people is Elton John bringing Pee-wee Herman in, or into the video? But it seems like there's also maybe
it's
some,
like, this gay camp type of thing.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, Elton John is very much of that era, you know.
Yeah.
And so I can see that
they'd probably be friends.
Yeah, they can see them getting along for sure.
Just kind of a random cameo there, but yeah, so he does that video.
So the initiation of how this investigation, I also found curious, like how it came to be.
It's very confusing.
Yeah. I read language in several articles that it said a tip from a witness led to the investigation into both Jeffrey Jones and Paul Rubens. And I read that language in a couple different articles, but like that's like a little bit, that's very ambiguous. I read one in another article that said the language was a complaint from a teenager led to an investigation on Paul Rubens and Jeffrey Jones. So that what sounds like is somebody made a complaint to police, and that led to police issuing a warrant to search both of their homes. When they searched Jeffrey Jones' home, he was arrested and he was charged with possession of child pornography and soliciting, because they found in his home, he had photos of a 14-year-old boy. And in these photos, they're described as like him being nude, wearing a cowboy hat. Photos of this 14-year-old boy nude with stuffed animals. Photos of him like dressed as like an Indian, like a Native American. And it sounds like these images, they do sound a little bit like as though he's trying to recreate the type of imagery that Pee-wee was caught with, right? This type of like retro homoerotic material. But
I thought you were going to reference the characters on Pee-wee.
Yeah, that too. Well, that too. And Jeffrey Jones, he was caught with this material and also charged with solicitation. And Jeffrey Jones, I think we didn't mention who he is. He's an actor who's very well known. You would recognize his face immediately if you've ever seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off, because right. he plays Principal Ed Rooney. And yeah. he's also in Beetlejuice. He plays Lydia's father in Beetlejuice. He's a very recognizable actor. Also, you know, working with Tim Burton there. But Jeffrey Jones pleads no contest to solicitation, and he receives 5 years probation and is forced to register as a sex offender. And this is definitely like a very effective cancellation. Jeffrey Jones did not work much after this.
Yeah. So he's the one who's caught with these photos of the 14-year-old boy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then what is the complaint
that led to the search? The complaint was also made about Paul Rubens, and that led to the search of his house, which led to charges against him as well.
So what do you think that is? Do you think that Jeffrey Jones and Paul Rubens were taking pictures of the boy together, and maybe only Jeffrey had the pictures?
It sounds like that's definitely possible.
Like that could be what's happening. And all of these pictures were that 14-year-old boy, and he's the one who called in the tip.
From my understanding, those are the ones that Jeffrey Jones was caught with, that he ended up being charged with.
Yeah.
And he was charged with like possession of child pornography and soliciting a minor because he was creating these photos. He was, you know, he had taken the photos or he was involved in making them. Pee-wee's charges were different. Pee-wee was charged with possession of child pornography initially for the material that they found at his house, but they found different stuff. He ends up pleading to lesser charges, which is a story that we've heard a lot. And those charges are misdemeanor possession. I wanted to preface this because there are so many long charges, titles of long charges that we've had to go through. And this is the longest one yet. In March 2004, Pee-wee Herman, Paul Rubens, pleads guilty to misdemeanor possession of obscene material improperly depicting a child under the age of 18 in sexual conduct. And this does come with a penalty. He is required to register his address with the sheriffs in Los Angeles County for 3 years. And he's also not allowed to contact a minor or be in the presence of a minor without their parents' approval.
So it's like basically like registering like a sex offender, but temporarily, and
not technically either. He's not on the sex offender registry, right. But he's being watched as though he were one.
It's just so interesting because he talks about this being art and erotica. And it's like, so is there any room for devil's advocate here? Like, could this have been an artistic photo shoot? Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts here?
Okay, well,
because
we're going to have to talk about that a lot. I had one other thought, which was I wanted to talk about him pleading out here and like pleading the charges, because I think that might be like this admission of guilt. Or it is an admission of guilt. It is literally an admission of guilt. But I think that in a lot of these other cases where we talk about like Brian Peck or Drake or maybe even Jeffrey Jones, a lot of those cases where they plead to like these lesser charges so that they can avoid the other charges seems like a way that people who are abusive or who have done like really awful things can avoid justice. And I think that we might be tempted to think that same thing in this case, but I would kind of disagree. And I also wanted to put that in context of plea deals and a little bit of how the justice system works, because the reality is that everybody pleads out. Every single case always leads. The entire justice system is weighted in a way that you are encouraged in every way to plead to charges instead of taking a case to trial. And 90 to 95% of criminal charges lead to plea deals. So almost everything ends in a plea deal. And that's because if you take a case to trial, then you will have to face all of the charges that are levied against you. Whereas if you plead to a couple of the charges, they'll drop the other charges and you'll only be sentenced for those. So you will receive a lighter sentence.
Right. Yeah. So I guess I asked that question again. With that all in context, like, what are your thoughts of those photos with just what we know? I know we don't know anything, but I'm just curious your thought process, because this one shocked me. I was like, oh, wow, this isn't the Pee-wee case that I thought. Which, like, the reason I even dove deep into Pee-wee was I was making the Pee Wee merch for our shop, and you had chosen Herman as your name for the show. Mm-hmm. So it was always, you know, we're going to do a Lorena Bobbitt episode, and this was a good time to do the Pee Wee episode. And I thought,
What
if I don't know everything about that masturbation charge? Like, maybe I should look in and make sure that he wasn't like super canceled. What if I have the wrong idea? And I still feel the same about his first arrest. I had no idea the second arrest happened. And that kind of hit me. And I was like, oh no, I'm going to have to think about this. And so tell me your thoughts first.
There's a lot of weird little twists to this, and there's a lot to dig into when it comes to trying to understand what happened here and what Pee-wee's charges were, what he actually had, and maybe if he got away with something or if something small got blown out of proportion or something that was at one time acceptable, that attitudes changed towards it and that he kind of got railroaded for it. So we'll let you make up your mind yourself, listeners, but we know that Pee-wee was a big collector of everything, of particularly like vintage items. And one of the things that he loved to collect is vintage erotica. And he particularly favored vintage like homosexual material. He loved like old like physique magazines and muscle magazines because he liked to collect material from like this past era. And this is material that's from a closeted era from where, you know, this type of thing would be like, you wouldn't be able to get your hands on it very much. And also an era in which if it was homosexual themed or coded erotica, then it would also have to be kind of like, it wouldn't be blatant, you know what I mean? It would have to be something that was kind of hidden or something in the subtext, you know? And so like, that's specifically what he had. Pee-wee claims that the images that he was caught with, specifically the images that he was caught with, and he was not caught with the same things that Jeffrey Jones had, and whether he had a hand in that, we don't know. He certainly wasn't charged with it, but he claims that the type of things that he were caught with did not portray actual sexual contact between underage people. He specifically says that one of the photos has a young man with a hand on his thigh. And because laws have changed about what is considered child pornography over time, and if a photo or if that material contains images that represent, even if like they don't have actual nudity or actual like sexual contact taking place in the photos, if they display like the language involves quote unquote sexual coyness or quote unquote lascivious intent, if you even have material that can be portrayed that way, then you can be charged with possession of child pornography or, you know, something more a bit obscure like what Pee-wee was charged with or pled to, possession of obscene material improperly depicting a child under the age of 18 in sexual conduct. Those laws are specifically in place so that they can charge people who, you know, like maybe they're taking out of context things that we've talked about before, like pictures of children with their shirts off or pictures of children in bathing suits. Or
I was going to mention, like, even the child pornography charges have changed just drastically in the last few years. If a teen girl or teen boy sends a photo of themselves to another teen, like, they're distributing child pornography of themselves. There's also the topic of, you know, taking pictures of your kids in the bath that seems really innocent and cute, and they're now on your phone and you have those photos. If something else happens, that can be used against you. What you put on the internet can be considered child pornography. Many people will post their baby's butts on Instagram and they're banned forever. Part of it being such a big issue is that it's such a broad term. So many things can fall into the category. And I'm not dismissing it or trying to minimize it by any means. This line between like art and porn is really thin, and then it changes. But what I'm curious about is this really a case that this was something that was art and he thought it was art? And it seems like when they went into his house, it says they found 70,000 items of memorabilia. It seems like this stuff was just sort of out. It wasn't like his hidden box of porn. It seems like it was like out in his collections from kind of what he hints. So I'm just like, I don't know. It seems kind of innocent.
And what you're saying is even more so when it comes to this type of like vintage erotica too, because this is material that comes from like homoerotic, like nostalgia that comes from a past closeted era. Some things that Pee-wee would have lived through or not. And it's an era in which you wouldn't be able to express those things openly, you know?
It says
and
some of these pictures were over 100 years old. It's wild.
Well, and then the argument could even be made up that do these things have historical value or not? Obviously, Pee-wee did. He collected them. It represents, like, when you're looking at these vintage, particularly, like, vintage, like, homoerotic material, it represents this past era of queerness, and it represents queer desire that takes place throughout time, you know? And I think that that's something that is appealing about this, like, not just necessarily the material itself, but what it represents and how it does that.
I'll read his quote about the charges. He said, "One thing I want to make very, very clear. I don't want anyone for one second to think that I'm
titillated
by images of children. It's not me. You can say a lot of things about me, and you might. The public might think I'm weird. They may think I'm crazy or anything that anyone wants to think about me. That's all fine. As long as one of those things you're not thinking about me is that I'm a pedophile, because that is not true."
Yeah, he does seem to make that very clear, at least what he says there.
You know what's interesting that I did find about this? Because we just came off the Drake episode, so it's fresh in my mind. And one thing about Drake Bell and his charges is that if he's not adamantly saying that none of this happened, the girl's crazy, whatever, the other thing that he does is he just completely avoids the topic. He uses a lot of very vague language to just sort of make the conversation die out. Pee-wee doesn't do this. He very much so vocalizes the images that were in his house, what was really there, how he felt about it, that they were art, that he doesn't feel guilty, that he's not a pedophile. He's very vocal over and over and over again, because in every interview, they ask him about this. What happened in the theater and what happened with the child porn? So I kind of give him credit for at least if he did it, that sucks. And I hope that this wasn't real child porn and that, you know, he wasn't a pedophile. But like, assuming that he's innocent, he does a really good job at just not backing down and facing this issue for what it is.
Do you remember how in Pee-wee's defense, how Pee-wee's lawyers described the material that was found?
I don't remember.
They said that he had a collection of kitsch and that he was also in possession of Rob Lowe's sex tape.
Yeah. Is that real?
Yes. So not only is Rob Lowe's sex tape real, Pee-wee was actually in possession of Rob Lowe's actual sex tape. Are you familiar with Rob Lowe's sex tape?
No.
I was not. So Rob Lowe in 1988, when he was 24, made a sex tape of him with two girls. One of them is 16 years old.
What the fuck?
And this video was circulated, and it was something that was kind of like it was around, it was traded. Paul Rubens, being a collector of things like that, happened to have a copy of it. But I think that Paul Rubens' lawyer brought it up as being part of Pee-wee's collection because, for one, this is material that portrays underage people performing sexual activity, but why would they be prosecuting Pee-wee for merely having a copy of this video, one that was widely distributed, when Rob Lowe himself was never charged?
Yeah.
So why would you not be charging the person who did it and charging somebody who just had the video years later?
Well, yeah. So he watched Rob Lowe's sex tape with a 16-year-old in it. I'm like processing this right now, live. Fuck. And I'm, like, not dismissing this by any means. I'm just being factual. This was, like, normal. Like, every actor, every rock star, they had teenage girls. It blows my mind. Everything's been ruined for me. Yep. Every time I put on a band t-shirt, someone's like, oh, don't you know that, like, he slept with 14-year-olds? I'm like, oh, cool. Awesome. And here we go. Ugh, it sucks. I want Pee-wee
to wear your Aerosmith or Led Zeppelin shirts.
I know. Steven Tyler, yeah, he was ruined for me very recently.
Well, another defense was made of Pee-wee potentially too, where I read an interview that included a quote from one of the dealers that Pee-wee used to buy his pornography from, because he used to buy a ton of this stuff, I guess. He bought a lot of it, yeah.
A porn dealer.
Yeah, back in the day here. And he specifically says that Pee-wee used to make lot purchases of stuff. He'd buy, like, you know, stuff in a box. Because what happens is, how this stuff becomes available is somebody who had a big collection of it dies, and then it becomes available, right? And they tend to sell it as a lot. And so if you were to buy it all together, you might not know if there were a few individual photos that portrayed something like that, something that was illegal.
So the sex tape could have just been in a box with a bunch of other shit.
Or the specific photos that he had that he ended up being charged with.
Right.
Or charged for. And then also, the dealer also says that when Rubens asked him for material, he asked for very specific things. He asked for vintage material, stuff from the 60s, that he liked physique magazines, and that he specifically asked for things that did not have kids in it.
Yeah. I mean...
Whether that's something that's drummed up to try and defend him, or whether that's... Because, I mean, I don't know, when you go to your porno guy, you're like, no child porn? Like, do you really need to specify that? But, I mean, what the guy said.
When it comes to, like, watching porn now, we do it all on our phone. You search what you want. You click the title of the video. And you hope that that is the video. If you're watching porn and it comes up with children or something horrible, you know, there's a place to report it. And then if you report it, you're not going to get in trouble for it being up on your screen. But it's much more intentional process of like, oh, I'm going to watch this type of porn, and this is the title of it, and this is what I'm going to watch. Whereas back then, like, you didn't know what was going to be in the magazine, really, until you opened it. You don't know what's going to be in the big box of collections. And then once you have it, if you don't really think much about it and you toss it to the side, or you just don't know what to do with it, do you throw it away? Is it collectible? Is it worth money? Are you supposed to sell it again? Like, these are questions that I'm not even sure he asked himself, that I wouldn't even know what to ask. This really is like a different time in that way. I'm not saying it's a different time for when it comes to what's okay with minors or not. I never excuse that with like, oh, it was back when it was normal to have sex with teenagers. No, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying just the way that he came across his material and the way he collected things was a different time. And this might be an unanswered question. We might not really know his innocence in this.
It does raise an interesting question when you consider it in context of, does vintage erotica or does any of this have historical value? And especially when you consider it in context of, some of these things would have been considered deviant at a time. Anything that was homosexual would be considered that way. And one interesting detail was that the specific photos that the police in Southern California confiscated from Pee-wee that he was charged for, they said that they were going to destroy those. And so that they're not kept in any sort of archive. And I don't really, is that commonplace for other child pornography cases? What do they do with that material?
Well,
is it archived or do they destroy it? I specifically remember reading that detail, Aaron.
I know a little bit about child pornography that's digital, right? Because we're in such a digital age.
Yeah, that's what I imagine,
and
how most of it is.
That's going to be different
now.
And of course, what they do is they try to swipe it from the internet as much as possible. But in a lot, I don't know if it's most or not, but in a lot of cases, it's nearly impossible to swipe it once it's been spread and spread and spread. And something interesting about child porn victims.
What about digital copies that are used as like evidence in cases, though?
Well, hold on. An interesting fact about child pornography that's digital, when you are a victim, every time that the police come across that material again, from whatever, someone has it downloaded,
yeah,
on their computer,
or on somebody's computer, every copy, right?
They get someone who has videos of child porn, and one of them is you. You get a call. It's part of your victim rights. You get a call every time that your photo is found in one of those cases again.
Oof.
So if you're like an 8-year-old kid who was abused, you're getting calls even when you're 50 years old. And if you're one of those cases where it had been spread a lot, and it is continued to be found over and over because it's so easy to spread digital content.
So obviously,
being told that you're being re-victimized and someone else just got off from your abuse, which is something that's horrible and is part of your victim rights.
Yeah, on one
you deserve
hand,
to
you
know every time
that
you've been
disclosed.
Victimized.
Yeah.
But then you might not want those calls anymore. So
yeah, probably pretty re-traumatizing.
And so again, the difference in the eras with this is also interesting because it's like, how different is the digital child porn world and the laws and victim stories? How different are they compared to like printed? Do they need these pictures and evidence? Like, do they eventually get rid of them? Because a lot of those photos of children being abused are going to show things like wounds and strangle marks and things like that that would be used in evidence.
Yeah, I feel like anything that's evidence in a case has to be.
And then also,
archived,
when children are sexually abused and they do get rape kits done, part of what's done is they take photos of any damage to the genitals and stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's photos that way that are done with evidence. So I imagine that those things are probably kept. I don't know. And those photos were taken from when, and do they even know the person in the photos? It seems like they were able to tag an age to the boy with his hand on his thigh. If I remember right, that was referenced to be a 15-year-old boy.
Or definitely in the Jeffrey Jones photos, it seemed like they knew the age, or they were able to find the victim, or the victim was the one who made the initial tip because he was charged with solicitation in the sense that he was responsible for making those photos.
Maybe he was the 15-year-old or something.
Yeah, it sounds like that. That's the big question mark for me is, you know, I don't really know the details about the images that Pee-wee had himself. I do, based on what I know about his collection, it sounds like, you know, they're forms of vintage erotica, whether you would consider those things that should be illegal or immoral or not. I think maybe there were some things that were pretty questionable or maybe even crossed the line a little bit. But it kind of seems as though it's also very possible that he had material that was at one time legal and that laws and attitudes changed and that he was prosecuted for having that material.
What's that movie that you showed me? Blue Lagoon or...
Mm-hmm, Blue Lagoon.
And they're literally, what, 12, 13 years old and they have sex in the movie and they're naked the whole time. And I'm like, is this okay? Is this art?
Does this have artistic value? Yeah.
Is this porn? Are we, like, is this okay now?
There's so much material that really does push those boundaries. And if you want my opinion, I think that you do have to really take that specific art and the context and what it is and how it was made and all of those things into consideration if you really want to make some sort of judgment on it. But the question that I have is whether Paul Rubens could have been involved with what Jeffrey Jones was doing, if in addition to being a collector of this erotica, that maybe it was possible that the two of them or other people were somehow involved in making it. And that would be pretty problematic. That door is left open and we really don't know. And as a Pee-wee fan, as a Paul Rubens fan, it's hard for me to want to consider that seriously. But I think in the service of like being honest to what I've read and what I understand, it's something that like has to be considered.
It sucks. It sounds like there's something there, though. There's things that we don't know. There's things he's not saying for sure. But then also, like, if they found problematic child porn, it seems like they would have, and I don't know if this is, you know, it's back in 2004, seems like they would have come down harder on him, too. I wish they could give us more details.
Or did he get away with it in the same way that, like, a Brian Peck or something, they're able to kind of slip off? Hey, it's kind of possible either way. Like I said, I don't want to have to throw away Pee-wee or Paul Rubens for that, but it has to be considered.
I'm going to read you the rest of the quotes from what he says about this arrest. He acknowledges that possessing a massive collection of what he called vintage erotica with titles like Boy Nudist and Shame Dame, as well as some photographic studies of teen nudes. But he said that the city attorney's office, what they view as pornography, he considers art. He said, magazines, photographs, films, incredible, beautiful stuff that I stand behind. The interviewer says, did you ever stop and think that while you were massing this collection, maybe it's not such a good idea, especially given what happened back in 1991? He said, I didn't. I never did. I wasn't really thinking to myself, wow, this is creepy, weird stuff that I shouldn't be collecting. It's not titillating. It's not something that I use for any kind of sexual purpose. The interviewer said, it is sensual, erotic to you? You acknowledge that? He says, I think some of it is erotic. Some of it is sensual. Most of it I don't view like that. It seems so innocent to me. You would immediately look at that collection and to tell very, very, very quickly, this is not a collection of child pornography. Well, it wasn't obvious to the city attorney's office. They've characterized it quite differently. I mean, they say that in and amongst these magazines were photographs that depict people underage engaged in masturbation, oral copulation, in short, pornographic images. He says, I know what they say. It depends upon whether it's you or the city attorney looking at them. It depends upon what one sees in those images, for example. The interviewer says, well, it's pretty clear and pretty specific. I mean, there were photographs of young men, boys, underage people performing, masturbating. Paul Rubens says, no, absolutely not, 100% not. He says, so then what are they referring to when they describe it that way? He says, one photograph, for example, has a young man with his hand on his thigh. It's close to his genitals, but not even that close. That's what they're calling someone getting ready to perform a sex act. One thing that he did mention that he always wished was that there would be a museum for Pee-wee that would contain all the playhouse sets and props he owned and Pee-wee toys and memorabilia.
And vintage erotica.
And Pee-wee kind of kept to himself. And all that we know is that in 2023, at the age of 70, he, without telling the public, died from leukemia and lung cancer. He had been sick for 6 years and he had chosen not to reveal his diagnosis to the public. And he released this statement. Please accept my apology for not going public with what I've been facing the last 6 years. I have always felt a huge amount of love and respect from my friends, fans, and supporters. I have loved you all so much and enjoyed making art for you. And he was cremated, and that was the end of Pee-wee.
He's supposed to be buried at Hollywood Forever, I read, but he's not. Yeah. He has not been interred yet.
So I have a couple wrap-up questions. The first one that I wanted to ask you is, do you think that the Pee-wee show would be allowed on TV now, or do you think it would be boycotted for being too gay? And why was this allowed back then?
Oh, I think it would definitely be allowed on TV now. I think that...
Allowed, but like, would it be criticized?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I think it would, there would be criticism for sure, but...
That's indoctrinating our children to be gay or something.
I mean, Pee-wee's Playhouse influenced so many shows that are on today. I read that Steve from Blue's Clues said Pee-wee was a big influence on him.
I believe that.
That the creator of SpongeBob said that Pee-wee was a big influence on him. So I think that like the type of humor and the kitsch, things like that, that were common in Pee-wee's Playhouse and in Pee-wee's humor, that those type of things live on for sure. And I think that the gay-coded humor as well, I think that's really, I mean, essentially it's only become more acceptable.
Yeah, but the more that something is accepted and out there, the louder the criticism of it gets.
Yeah, I just you're going to have those knee jerks as well.
I mean, like, we still have Disney. We have Disney Plus. We have all of that. But then there's also, like, an entire wave of people who think that Disney is indoctrinating our children and, like, satanic, pedophilic, whatever. So, anyways, my next question for you.
Yeah, is that your answer? Do you think that Pee-wee's Playhouse would exist today?
I think it could exist today. I mean, I don't think it would because the humor and style is a little different. We have our own versions of it now, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's unique.
Yeah, but I don't know if it would hit the same. We love it because it's nostalgic and weird and we were built on that and that humor, so we get it. My kids don't get it. My older kids, they think it's dumb. They, you know, I have a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old. The baby thinks it's funny.
I mean, the baby watches Mickey Mouse Funhouse all the time and it's like a playhouse, you know? This concept
so there's
is not...
new. Yes.
I mean, obviously it wasn't unique to Pee-wee too. He was doing like a Soupy Sales thing or doing...
But the jokes...
Howdy Doody, like this is, you know, he was bringing back a lot of the tropes as well, but
the jokes don't hit for my other kids, and I've been trying to introduce it to them for years, and it's like we're in a different generation that has different types of humor.
And so
you know, some version of it would still exist today, but if Pee-wee specifically came out today, I'm not sure. I mean, it wouldn't. It was made in the time that it was made for a reason. And then also I think it would have heavy criticism of indoctrinating our children. We've got lots of book ban issues and
agree with you there.
Drag queen issues and what can our kids see and not see. And he would have 100% be deemed as gay today. How it was a little bit more hidden queer coded back then, I can't relate to because I wasn't alive then. So it's kind of mind blowing that he got away with being flamboyantly gay on TV for children at a time when, from what I understand, was more homophobic than now.
Of course.
It kind of blows my mind.
By being so ambiguous about it was a very smart way to do that.
I don't think it would appear ambiguous today.
Probably less so. I think people would maybe be able to read between those lines a little bit more, as I'm sure they were then. And it's not like he didn't come under fire, wasn't criticized then, or just thought of as being weird, I guess.
Yeah. Anyways, so my next question to you is, why do you think the two cases were treated so differently? He was so heavily canceled for his first arrest. And his second arrest, no one really knows about it. He wasn't really canceled again, necessarily. Like, maybe in a legal way because he couldn't be around children. But it doesn't seem like to this day, but also back then, that it was talked about as much as his first cancellation.
It does seem like the second one is potentially a lot more serious.
A lot too. More serious. Do you think because the first one was funny?
Yeah, actually, yeah. I think that is really one of the primary reasons. Also because that was at the height of Pee-wee's fame. And it became this big media thing where it was like a big joke. Whereas the cancellation later, that joke had already been made. You can't make the same joke twice. And also, like, Pee-wee was pretty effectively canceled. You know what I mean? Like, he was very famous, and then he didn't really appear very much after that.
So he didn't get canceled again because he was already canceled, basically.
Yeah, kind of. I think he was able to maintain, like, a cult status. And then later in life, he was able to parlay that into maintaining some notoriety and working more and even doing more Pee-wee stuff because, you know, of his cult status, there have always been lots of people who are fans. They want to see more Pee-wee. But I think that it could kind of already happened. It was like, I think in the public's mind, it was kind of a double jeopardy thing, even though on further consideration and on deeper consideration, that does fall apart a little bit because they're pretty different situations.
See, I would have been, I guess, about 12 when the second arrest happened. So I missed that. But you had to have been about 20. Do you remember it happening in the news?
I was in college, and like that was an era where I was probably not following the news all that closely. So I think I may have heard about it. Like, it does sound familiar. Like, I remember hearing about it, but I don't really remembering like hearing about the details of it or digging into it. I wasn't really, that it's more of a personal thing where I wasn't watching the news.
Yeah, I was just wondering how the media really covered it, and I couldn't really find much. Well, my last question to you is, on a scale of 1 to 10, how canceled is Pee-wee for you, and are you still proud to be Herman on this show?
That is a good question. 1 to 10, I don't know, like 3, I guess. It really depends because I think that one...
With just what you know.
It's hard for me. For one, I'll always love what Pee-wee has done. I'll always think it's funny. I'll always think it's great, even if those things were true. That's not going to change regardless of how I would feel about the person who made it if I found out that some of those things were true. The 1991 thing, who cares? Dude, you whack off in a theater, everybody does it. Who cares? I mean, maybe not in public, maybe you shouldn't, but, you know, you're in a whack-off theater. That's totally acceptable, in my opinion. Who cares? The other one, the details are a little questionable, and so it makes the cancellation questionable for me. I think that there's definitely a chance that he was involving himself in some stuff that he shouldn't have, and I think that would be a bummer to know about, but we don't really know it for sure.
For me, it's really hard for me to separate the cancellation from the art. I can't do that. I am a huge Bill Cosby fan. I have never been able to go back and watch it. I don't want to think about how some of the people in the show, the characters that I love, could have been harmed by him. I feel exactly the same way about Michael Jackson. Every time a Michael Jackson song comes on, I do not just listen to the song without thinking about what he's done to children. And then Pee-wee is on a children's show. So it's like, if he did this and it's real, and he really was a pedophile, it makes it really hard for me to even want to watch it with our baby, to be honest. I'm like, fuck, dude, his jokes are a little weirder. He's saying them on the screen to my kid, and he may have been watching child porn. So it's like my feelings on him really hang on the questions that remain unanswered about those photos and what he was doing. It's really, I mean, for me, he's canceled at like a 5.5. But if it was real and he really is a pedophile that was like watching child porn, that goes all the way for me.
Yeah, it's interesting to consider for sure.
So how do you feel about taking the namesake Herman? You still feel okay about it?
Yeah, we're sticking with it. Can't change now.
Can't change it now, but I don't know if we need a disclaimer now. Well, we're curious what you guys think. We're really like open to your guys' ideas. So you guys should hit us up on social media and especially on our Patreon where we've got conversation going about it. And I want to know how you guys feel after hearing this.
Yeah, we're preparing our next Patreon episode. We got a little behind this week because Lorena had a dental procedure.
I got all my wisdom teeth.
Yeah, it set us back a little bit. So
I don't want people to think
us.
My teeth are rotten. I just had wisdom teeth. A lot of them. And it sucked. It hurt way worse than I thought. Yeah, dozens of wisdom teeth.
She had so many wisdom teeth taken out.
Anyways, I'm almost better. It kind of hurt to talk through this, but I made it through.
Yeah. Thank you for suffering for our podcast.
Yes. So coming this week, we're going to have another Patreon episode, and I'm going to have Herman on my other podcast, Sex Without Fear. I'm going to bring him on for an episode that I'm looking forward to talking about. I'm not going to give any spoilers here because it's so off topic. But yeah.
Can we wrap it up? Are we done with our thoughts here?
Yeah, were there anything about the Patreon or shop that we needed to say? Or
buy our crap. buy our awesome podcast merch. Look for some new podcast merch hitting the store soon. I made a few new designs, but there's going to be definitely some Pee-wee themed stuff hitting the store, which I'm excited about. I'm going to make one for myself, so you should get one too. A free Pee-wee shirt.
Yeah. Find us at the Patreon. You can subscribe for free and take part in our polls and stuff. But to get those extra episodes, you got to subscribe for what, $2?
Yeah, I'm going to keep the price real low for now.
$2.
Make it easy on
Patreon. You. Yep. That you're basically getting 2 Patreon episodes a month. So it's $1 an episode.
We're
going
to try and post at least 2 episodes. We're shooting for weeklies. So we're going to try and have 4, but we're going to have at least 2, I think.
Yeah, so if you're missing us here on Spotify or wherever you're listening and you just need more content, we're putting out those Patreon episodes in between. So we will see you guys there.
And they're fun to do. I think this was a fun episode and those are really fun to do too.
And everyone's been asking us to reveal our faces and I think I've almost got Herman convinced that that's what our Patreon is for. So
you might
get to meet us. All right, we'll see you guys over there.
Yep, bye.
Somebody who believes in exactly why you're here tonight. You know him as one half of a comedy team. This is what really to tell your children about Pee Wee Herman. This is from Teller of Penn and Teller. You've never heard him speak, but if he had spoken, this is what he would say. If your child asks you about Pee Wee's big adventure in Florida, you have 2 choices about what to tell him. You can say that Paul Rubens, the actor writer, performs as Pee Wee as a grown up in a free country, and our Constitution says that we're allowed to see any kind of movie we like. People who like history can see historical movies, people who like religion can see religious movies, and people who like sex can see sexy movies. There are even theaters especially devoted to sexy movies so that grown-ups can go and masturbate while watching sexy movies. Without bothering people who don't want to see or think about sex. Tell your child that freedom to choose is how we make ourselves happy without hurting other people, and it's a lot of what the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are about. But in some places, selfish pigs push their way into government and manage to slip by laws that try to prevent people from just having fun. This is... God, you can applaud at these points. This is how Paul got into trouble. He went to a movie theater where you're supposed to watch sexy movies and masturbate. But in that community, there was an old law that said that it was okay to have theaters that show sexy movies and get people excited, but not okay for them to masturbate. Pretty silly law, right? You'd expect the police to spend much of their time hiding in a theater to catch people breaking the anti-fun law when they could be out catching murderers, right? No one even proved Paul guilty, but all of a sudden everybody got very excited because Paul was famous. It's the same sort of thing that happens with big movie stars and marriage problems. Nosy people with boring lives like to make a big stink when famous people have trouble. Paul's bosses in the television show got all scared, and if they stood behind their employee who was accused of violating the anti-fun law, the nosy people with the boring lives would say stinky things about them. Even though it's a good television show that lots of people like. It's too bad they were not braver or more loyal. Tell your child that it's important that she or he help fix this situation by telling our lawmakers and our television broadcasters that we think the whole thing is unfair to Paul and the fans of his show. We should all help to get rid of anti-fun laws. And we should make fun of people who are cowards in the face of stinky talk by nosy people with boring lives. In conclusion, however, if you are a nosy person with a boring life, then tell your child that Pee-wee led a secret life as a wicked man who put on a false beard and wig and may have tried to undermine our society by playing with himself. Tell your child never ever to enjoy a work of art by a person whose lifestyle is different than his own. Inculcate your child that all laws are just and that freedom means the right to do only the things that please everybody. And be sure to teach your child that Thomas Jefferson was a jerk for writing that junk about the right of the pursuit of happiness.